Welcome back to another edition of the Fried Egg Podcast. Today's episode is brought to you by Athletic Brewing. If you are looking for a great non-alcoholic beverage, let me introduce you to Athletic Brewing, who make wonderful tasting craft non-alcoholic beer. As a new father, I have found this stuff particularly great. It lets me have a beverage or two and unwind at night while keeping me clear-headed and easy to wake up during those odd hours you find yourself awake as a new dad. I am particularly a big fan of Athletic's Run Wild IPA, which is a low in calorie, 70 to be exact, 70 calories, fully fermented and awesome tasting beer. They offer free shipping nationwide, and you can purchase these wonderful beverages at athleticbrewing.com. And if you use our discount code FRIEDEGGFALL20, you will get an additional 20% off your order. That's FRIEDEGGFALL20, all one word, capitalize the F-E-F, so FRIEDEGGFALL20 for 20% off your order. Today's episode is with Jeff Ogilvy, who, of course, won the last U.S. Open at Wingfoot, the 2006 U.S. Open at Wingfoot. It was great to talk with Jeff, as it always is, and get insight into Wingfoot and what he expects this week and what he went through in 06. As U.S. Open week is pretty much here, we will be chock full of coverage on our various channels at the Fried Egg. So a couple things to look out for. If you don't already, be sure to subscribe to our free newsletter. It is sent out during major weeks every day, and you'll never miss anything that we do or anything that's going on in the championship. On the podcast, we will have a couple new episodes, including a Fried Egg story from Garrett that will be centered around the U.S. Open at Wingfoot, a historic U.S. Open at Wingfoot. And then also, subscribe to our YouTube page and check it out. We have a great video of Wingfoot up with Gil Hanse and Jeff Ogilvy talking about the greens. And we will also be debuting our second episode of Digging into Design, which will feature Gil Hanse talking about the West Course at Wingfoot. So that'll be kind of like a it's kind of like a podcast, that Digging into Design series, but with video. So when he's talking about features on the golf course, we're going to show you what he's talking about, or historical photos that they used during the restoration, we're going to show you. I think it's just a better format to talk about a golf course than necessarily a podcast, which we've done a lot of over the years. So without further ado, here is Jeff Ogilvy.
I miss a green, for example. I'm already upset. When I find my ball in the bunker, I'm really upset. And when I find my ball in a
fried egg.
Fried egg.
The dreaded fried egg.
Fried egg.
Fried egg.
Fried egg.
Fried egg.
Fried egg lie. I'm about ready to run off the golf course.
It will be a game. It'll be a make or break for him, actually. I mean, you can tell right now for you, like the way you look at things changes a little bit. You know what I mean? Like, he might just not want to be overseas as much. He might want to be at home a bit more. And I don't know. We'll see. It changes a few guys. Some guys without a conscience keep playing well or better. You know, guys with a conscience, and he is one with a conscience. I don't know. It's 50-50 after kids. You know, it's different.
Do you believe, okay, so this is a question I had for you. Will it wins right after baby? There's been a lot of anecdotal stuff about basketball guys having a baby and then shooting. They're unconscious shooting for a couple weeks after. Do you believe in any kind of post baby bump?
Yeah, I would believe in a post baby bump short term. That it would be potential. Like, that it would be, because you're so high on life, right? It is, nothing is better. Like, everything is good, you know, and it's quite a scary thing having a baby. You know what I mean? Like, this, all of a sudden you think there's things that can go, you've never worried about stuff before in your life. And now it's like, you're worried about things going wrong, or is this baby going to be all right? I hope everyone's healthy. I hope my wife's all right. And so when it all happens and it's just such a happy moment, I think you can get a bump. But I think long-term, it's a challenge for a guy who wants to be around his kids and his family, because the tour life is, even when you're at home, you're at the golf course all day and then you go away all the time, you know, and it's not all the time, like 3 weeks is 3 weeks, you know? So guys handle that stuff different, both sides of it, I think.
And your kids can only travel with you for so long until they have lives.
Ours came till the first one went to school, really, you know, and then, which is 5 years. And then, yeah, they need their lives. Yeah, they need their friends and their setup, and it's not fair to them to get dragged all around the world. So it's fun for them a little bit, but not every week, you know. There's some guys on tour who like homeschool their kids, and they do it pretty much full-time travel with their kids. But that's a full commitment too. That makes playing the golf different too, right?
Yeah, and it's got to be tough on the kids because they don't, you know, they're friends, you know. But
yeah, it was funny. It's funny, especially it's the same. The tour life is interesting like that. It's my kids had a bunch of friends for the first 5 years of my oldest life and 4 years of the next one. Their friends were tour friends, kids of my peers. You know, all our friends, our world was there. And then they start going to school, and so they move on to their school friends. And they don't know any of the other kids anymore that they grew up with the first 5 years. It's quite an interesting world, the tour world. There's 5 year runs of like kids coming out, and then they disappear and new ones come out, you know, because everyone goes to school and stays at home all of a sudden. It's interesting.
The other thing that's different about golfers and kids is that your guys' careers are generally longer and into your life later than a, you know, a football player. They're done at 28, 29. Basketball player, very rarely over 33. And, you know, you guys could play the senior tour all the way till you're 60, you know?
That's the interesting thing about our careers is I start with all these, I mean, it was me and Scotty and Justin Rose and Immelman and Garcia and all in that sort of thing. And then Luke Donald and Poulter, and gradually people have kids and like, and then later on, other guys have kids, and my kids are kind of teenagers now, and Scotty's are really young, and like it's just the different phases of things. Like I start bringing kids out on tour, and I'm dragging diaper bags, you know, through the airport, and I'm like doing that sort of nightmare thing, which is great. It's a great period in your life, but it's also crazy. And then I get, I'm finally over that, and you start going on your own, and it's just kind of fun too, right? But then you've got the tragedy. You're leaving your kids at home. You know, and then all your friends are now carrying the diaper bags around and you're back to doing it solo. It's just funny because the career, like you say, it goes for like 30 years or more. You live people's lives with them in a way, you know. You junior golf when they're single and you're young and you're kind of running around, then you all kind of get married, then you all have kids, and then the kids and wives are all stay at home and you're back to single again by the time you're late 40s. You know what I mean? Not single, but traveling solo again. You know, it's just the journey you take on tour is not, it's not the same all the time. Like as your life changes, the way the tour works changes, you know, it's kind of fun.
It's gotta be a cool part when you all get on tour and like everybody's starting to have success. That's gotta be like a cool moment when everybody that you grew up playing with and around you has, you know, made it. And then
it was the best.
Yeah.
It was the best. I mean, my first year in Europe, we had five people in the house. We had a caddy, a drummer, he was caddying for me, and we had Steve Allen, who was playing in Europe at the time, who's played a lot of PGA Tour and Web.com, Korn Ferry, Marcus Wheelhouse, and Steve Alka, who still plays up and down from the Korn Ferry. And that. So we had four golfers. And if one of us came home on Sunday night and made £10,000, so if someone's made five figures, we went out all night. That was it. We were celebrating for a week. If one guy made £10,000, now it's like 10,000, 15,000 for last place at like the John Deere or something, right? But if someone made £10,000, we were dining out for 3 days on how happy we were for our friends. And to see guys fight for their card and have that great week late in the year, or some guy gets his first win, or that journey through as people come up through, it's just it's a brilliant period. It's fantastic. Yeah. And you hope a couple of guys struggle, but a couple of guys are going well. And like, it's just a great journey, golf like that, when it goes well. I mean, it's a brutal one when it doesn't, but those days are fun.
In a way, you don't get teammates in golf, but you get your guys that you essentially spent your whole life with.
Yeah. I mean, I've spent my life with, well, my working life with the same bunch of people generally. Yeah. It comes and goes. You're definitely on the same team in a way. You're very rarely, like, I think if we played match play, like the tennis, if it was tennis head to head, I think the locker room would be a little bit frostier, you know. But because 72 hole stroke play is a brutal thing to do anyway. And also, there's more than one winner in a stroke play tournament. It's the guy who hasn't made a cut for a while. He finally makes a cut. He's a winner, you know, and there's a few of them every week. There's a guy who hasn't had a top 10 for 3 years. He has a top 10. He's a winner. The guy who, like, wins the tournament's a winner. There's lots of little winners. Whereas match play, there's a winner and a loser. So 50% of every day, half the people are headless and they don't like the guy that just beat them, right? Stroke play is different. If you haven't had a good tournament, you've had a run of 20ths and you have a 10th. That's a good week. It's like a mini victory. So I think because it's like that, we're all quite happy to, we want everyone else to do well anyway, because we realize a good year is only winning once or twice, and three times or something. It's 95% of the tournaments we play, other people are going to win. So you'd rather your friends win those than everyone else, right? It's such a hard job. If someone asks you for help on tour, everybody helps. Everybody. No one says, nah, I'm not going to tell you that. Because it's just such a hard, it's not going to make the guy beat you. It's just helping him because you've needed help before. You know, it's such a, it's nice like that, golf.
Yeah, I was looking at like John Rahm after he won BMW. 11 wins and at the time 104 pro starts, but that includes some as an amateur. His win rate's like 11%. And it's astronomical. You think about it, it's like, oh, that's not that high. But Tiger's 22, and then there's nobody else higher than John Rahm at 11%.
11's outrageous. I mean, 1 in 10? I mean, if you play 30 a year, that's 3 tournaments a year. That's a pretty good rate. But comparative to other sports, it's like the numbers are like, what, really? 10%? Nah, come on.
Yeah, you think about baseball, they always make that joke about, oh, if you bat 300, you're a Hall of Famer. In golf, if you 5%, if you 5% win rate, you're one of the all-time greats.
Yeah, it's like a measure of like failing the least as opposed to winning the doing the most, right? Baseball hitting is the same. Yeah, if you hit it 3 out of 10 times, you're a Hall of Famer. Like, that's kind of nutty, right? If you win 2 out of every 10 tournaments, you're the one of the best golf. You're the best golfer of all time. Like, it's just crazy. 20% is crazy, though, by the way. That's 1 out of 5.
Oh, my God.
That's unbelievable.
And that includes, like, the last 10.
That is unbelievable. That concludes a few years where he didn't win any.
Yeah.
You know? It's just outrageous.
I didn't have time. I was going to look at what it was from 99 to 09. It would probably be closer to 30%.
I think it would have to be, wouldn't it? I mean, he had a couple of 7, 8, 9 win years, didn't he?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then it's like the top 10 rate is insane. It's like, I think he's over 50% of the time he's finishing top 10.
Which is just not even right, is it? It's such, people have no idea when they look at his numbers. If they only watch Tiger's numbers, they just think, oh yeah, top 10, easy. It's not that easy.
That was the thing that I came out of it, as I looked at like Ernie and Phil, their win rates were 7%. And it was, and then you look at like Rory, DJ, they're at 7-8%. And obviously, you know, Phil and Ernie have dropped some because of, you know, the last 6 years of their career. But my conclusion was we should be comparing all the next big thing to Phil and Ernie, not to Tiger.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Tiger's the outlier. You can't use him. You can't use him. It's the numbers are so distorted from the rest that Tiger's Tiger, you know. Jack's numbers are pretty nutty too. He won over 20% of his tournaments his whole life.
Yeah. I think Hogan was 30%.
Considering he was 0 for 200 at the start, it's pretty nuts, isn't it?
And he had a life threatening car crash too.
He couldn't
in the
walk.
Middle.
Yeah.
It's the all time greats, you know, are really great. Interested to hear your thoughts. 2 years in, what do you think of the FedEx Cup playoff format?
I was on the pack when we were talking about this, and it was, I guess, the issue that everyone had with it was just a bit confusing. Like, the whole time, it's always been confusing, right?
Yes.
It's never been obviously simple to just, you have to kind of read the fine print to work out what's going on. And you still kind of do in a way because it's so different. But the idea is you actually don't. It's actually relatively simple. Whatever the board says, that's the FedEx Cup board. It's actually created a FedEx Cup leaderboard effectively for the last 4 days. I don't mind it. The right guy won, clearly, right? I mean, He may not have been the best player for the 12-month season, but he was certainly the best player at the right time. You know,
he was without a doubt the best player in the playoffs.
Oh, by a mile. I mean, Olympia Fields was just, that finish was just beyond outrageous. And the play golf he played there. And then the golf he played at Boston was just not, that's not human, you know. And then to go and win, I know he technically didn't win East Lake, but he won East Lake five in front, finishes it off with Clark. I mean, yeah, when he's there, like Kisner's quote's perfect. When he's feeling it, like, what do you say? When feeling it, I just try to make a bit of money to fill up my bank account. Like, I ain't catching that guy. That's actually true. You're not catching Dustin when he's feeling it. It's a bit like Rory. Him and Rory feeling it would be interesting, you know, because they both go so crazy low and, like, dominate fields, you know. Brooks dominates tough golf courses, and he dominates that down the stretch thing, you know. Mm-hmm. But Dustin and Rory, they don't have a governor. When they get going, they just, it's fun to watch.
To win by 11 with, like, the world's, I mean, one of the best fields of the year. It's just, I don't care where it is. It's insane. You won by 6. Were you just in the zone that week?
Kapalua, I won by 6. Yeah, I played so well that week. And it's funny, I started 6 in front. And those leads are really hard on Sunday. It's the only time I ever had any sort of significant lead. And it was really weird. And I played kind of weird and tense and stuff the first 8 holes, and I was back to only 1 in front going up 9, and then I made a great eagle on 9 at Kapalua, and then I was away, right? And I ended up winning by 6, but winning by 11, and I was just, that was the best I ever played probably on a course that really suited me, and there's only 30 guys there. So winning by 6 at Kapalua is not winning by 6, winning by 6 somewhere else in a full normal field is more impressive, right? Because you've beat more guys. So 11 guys at Boston on a course that would be hard to separate, because everybody finds it relatively easy to make a few birdies, you know. It finds a good player. That's actually Wingfoot relative to like a Boston. I think they're both, that it's a good comparison. You still find great players have won at Boston all the way through. If you look at who have won there, and it's always been low, but it's always great players. So it finds players who have every shot, right? And the best player in the currently at the moment just won by 11. So fair play. It's finding the best player. But also Olympia Fields found the best player too, you know, the next week.
And that was so, the thing with Boston too, was Harris English was kind of out on his own in second too. He was clearly the second best player that week.
It was a bit like the last time we saw something like that was Troon, right? With Stenson and Mickelson. They just, I mean, third played the best tournament ever at Troon. I mean, they're the best. They played the third best Open Championship ever, and they finished third by 15 shots or something. But yeah, Boston's great. That's a good course. I'm glad it's certainly a long hitter's course. Like, it had a massive advantage to fly the trouble. But yeah, Dustin, wow. What a level they're playing at the moment. But like, in 2 weeks' time, that could be JT. Mm-hmm. You know, and 2 weeks later, it could be Brooks could be coming back. Well, Brooks is a bit hurt, but when he gets fit, he could be that guy. Rory could easily just go bang. You know, it's like we haven't had it like this for a long time. There's 10 potential number ones in the world, you know, and there hasn't been before. Maybe more.
I've always thought that winning tournaments is one thing, but blowing out people is a whole different level of golf.
Yeah, that's true. It's just, and I say, I only ever did it once, and 6, again, it's a short field, isn't that thing? But I was playing so well at that time. And so for these guys who, Tiger and Dustin, that who can routinely, like, just annihilate fields, the level they're playing at is so far in front of everyone else in the field. It's just crazy. You know, it's amazing that people can get as good as Dustin is, don't you think?
Yeah.
Like, it's wow. It's just what? 30 under a week. I mean, 6 under a day is not 30 under a week. You're 6 shots short. If you shoot 6 under a day, you're 6 shots behind Dustin. That's nutcase level, you know?
So this is my issue with the FedEx Cup final. I make it to East Lake. I could go out and shoot 65 every day and not win on an extraordinarily tough golf course. I think if you're there, everybody should have an equal shot.
Well, this is the big argument, right? No, so I was in the pack the whole time this happened. The argument is you've got to find the balance between rewarding the season, rewarding the 25 starts everyone's made, and having a playoff, A true playoff would be exactly as you say. You get to East Lake, the winner of East Lake wins it all. You know, that's the true playoff. They don't want to do that because the players are never going to vote for that, because the players want to get rewarded for their body of work. So this is a compromise between the body of work, mathematically possible that everyone in the field can win, but they make it difficult for the 30th guy to win and they make it easier for the first guy to win, really. They want it to be a playoff. I think deep down, if Pontevedra had the chance, that they would go a little more aggressive on that. But the players have to vote for it because it's a players' organisation. And players are never going to vote for that, you know, because they don't want the guy to be 125th getting into the first one, find his way, somehow have a miraculous week, finish 30th and win it all. You know, that's the players hate the idea of that.
That's what makes the NCAA tournament.
The idea of it.
Yeah. That's what makes the NCAA tournament the greatest 3 weeks in sports.
You know, and I think that would be brilliant. I think I always thought it would be nice to top 30 to get rid of a part of the field every day. You know, maybe you play the first 36 with the 30 and you get rid of 15 and you've got 15 going out on Saturday, starting at scratch, and you get rid of 5. And then you all go back to square on Sunday and you've got 10 guys, $15 million add-in holes, go. Like, that would be TV, you know, or 8 guys or 4 guys or something. Can you imagine? But again, that's probably a little aggressive for people. You know what I mean? I don't mind. This is the best version of it so far, I think.
I like the 5 guys having a chance. You know, there's 2 schools of thought. And now they have that Wyndham Rewards, right?
Yeah. Which is why they put that in, because of to reward the season, to kind of soften that for the players. We're going to look after the guy who plays the best for the year, you know?
So now that you have that, I think East Lake's got to be anybody there can win, because you've made it. You've made it all the way there. Nobody there has had a bad year.
No. And I mean, nobody gives the best golfer in the world a head start at the Masters every year.
Exactly.
Everyone has to start at the same score, US Open. It's like, well, and yeah, I agree in theory that it would be really great to have it all come down to a few guys on the Sunday. Go, boys. What TV that would be. What entertainment that would be. And what pressure you'd see, guy. I mean, you'd actually see 15 million moves the needle for a lot of people. You know what I mean?
Yeah. And like down the stretch, all the stuff. I mean, that we got it a little bit yesterday, but they didn't acknowledge it. But like JT and Xander were clearly, they were, because I mean, they're playing for $2.5 million.
Yeah.
And yeah. I mean, this is more than a win on tour.
Yeah, it's nuts. It's a strange thing. It's so much money. It's amazing. It's a good thing. Look, I always liked East Lake. Every version I played of the Tour Championship, I liked. This one I haven't played in this format, so I'm not sure. But I just like when the guy who was playing best at the time wins it, and this time it happened. So
I think last year it happened too, which is like the big thing for this. Is like Rory was clearly playing the best of anybody last year, and DJ was clearly playing the best of anybody this year, and they both won. So, I mean, that's the big saying, you know.
And if you look at the winners since, was it 07 we started it? If you look at the guys who have won it, it's pretty much, with the exception of Bill Haas, who at the time was clearly, I mean, he's a lovely bloke, but he was like 23rd or something going into that week. With the exception of Bill Haas, who's a great player and worthy of winning anyway, it's been Vijay, Furyk, Tiger, McIlroy, Dustin. Like, it's been the who's who of the tour. So it has identified, like, the superstars. So the format does find the superstar, but it would be nice if there'd be more Bill Haas stories.
I think, yeah, because I think that's what makes it.
He won't even notice the 15 go in his bank account. You know what I mean? Well, you will. 15 you do. But you know what I mean? Whereas the 27th guy in the field or something, I mean, that's a life changer. You know, he's not seeing 15 million in career earnings, whereas Dustin's probably got 50 in career earnings, you know?
Yeah, I think he's up to like 86 million now. With this?
Combining all the FedEx, the bonuses and stuff? Yeah. That's...
And, I mean, just on course.
That's so nuts.
I saw Scotty Scheffler. He made 2.5 on the course this year. Then he got 2.5 bonus.
Mm-hmm.
Or something like... He ended up making $5 million, and his best finish in a tournament was 3rd.
Yeah, look, it's good to be... It's good. It's a good time to play good.
Yeah.
You know? It's a good time to play. Well, there's... I mean, they're... it seems to this point it's been recession proof. And I think, to be honest, COVID's actually helped golf, you know, because it's, you're never going to have trouble getting people back to golf tournaments because you can keep people separated, right? Whereas football stadiums, basketball stadiums, that's like just a petri dish for like virus spreading, right? So, I mean, it's golf is, and it's a healthy exercise thing that you can do outdoors and keep yourself safe. I think golf is just going to get bigger. I really do. And
yeah.
More popular. And
the thing,
it's been what golf needed. COVID's been what golf needed.
It's the dirty secret of the whole thing is that the pandemic is like the best grow the game initiative that the golf has ever had.
Yeah, the power brokers in golf got together. Yeah, this is good for us.
Yeah. I want to change gears. We got U.S. Open coming up.
Yeah.
At a venue you won. Good tournament weeks, I always remember weird little things. Is there a small moment, like a small little thing that you remember vividly from 06 that's not making a putt on, like, you know, the back nine, but any kind of small thing that whenever you think about it, you remember?
My most vivid memory is kind of silly. It's not silly. It's obvious when you think about it. But we were there for 2 weeks. We played Westchester the week before, same hotel, the whole thing. And the World Cup was on. It was the World Cup soccer was on. And Australia had got in the World Cup for the first time for my lifetime anyway. And we were in the group with Brazil. And on Sunday morning, I was in the fitness trailer, like next to the range. And I late started my warm-up because Australia was playing Brazil. Because it was such a big deal, you know, and we played really well. We ended up losing the match, but I remember my vivid memory is watching Australia play Brazil on Sunday late. Was Saturday or Sunday? I think it was Sunday, and I late started my warm up because I had to watch the end of the football game. It's kind of silly.
So Sunday, that was Sunday or Saturday.
I'm pretty sure it was Sunday. It was definitely late in the tournament. I have to go back and look at the schedule of that tournament, but yeah. Because the fitness trailer was a refuge for us on tour because there's a TV in there. And like the fitness trailer back then, it's a bit more popular now. More guys go in it now, but it's been a growing thing. It's one of those things in January, everybody's in the fitness trailer, right? But by the time you get to like April or May, like the New Year's resolutions are gone and only the guys who are always in there are in there. And I used to just didn't do much, but I stretched a lot and stuff. So I went in there every morning and the guys who were always in there were always in there and we would just watch TV and stuff in there. It was a great little hangout. And that week in the Wingfoot, it was right next to the putting green. So it's a little refuge away from all the craziness, you know. It's just players and trainers just sitting in there watching TV and stretching and warming up. And we're watching the football in there. It was brilliant. Anyway, Ian Poulter wore head to toe pink on Sunday. That's one of my big memories too. He was my playing partner, second last group. And he was in that Doug Sanders kind of phase of his life where everything that he wore had to be the same color. And it's Father's Day in New York. And it's pink hat, pink shirt, pink shoes, pink bag, pink head covers, everything. And I was invisible in my group, right? They didn't even see me because it was like, he just let off this lightning rod of like, just attack me and yell at me because I'm wearing all pink today. Baby pink. Oh my goodness. So he actually really looked after me because I had an unscathed like 5 hours through a New York crowd, you know, because they didn't even notice me because I wasn't wearing pink. It was brilliant.
That's, yeah. Those are the days of IJP design.
IJP design, yeah. And he had all the FootJoy classics or the icons. I think they were, I guess, the icons of FootJoy. And he had like every custom color that there was. At that time, a lot of guys on tour travel with these club glove things. And he traveled with like five of them. And one of them was just full of shoes. Like just full of foot. He had like seven pairs of foot joys he wore for the week because they all had to match his stuff. Oh, what a production.
How many shoes did you travel with?
Two, usually. I would have two, like a white or a black or two different, and I would kind of rotate them day to day. But I became very, I just wear a pair of shoes out and then I'd get a new pair. I was kind of more that way. Like they're very important shoes, you know, as for a health perspective, you know, they're feeling good and you're not getting blisters and you kind of know where you stand, if you like. Some guys wear new shoes all the time. Oh, I couldn't do that. He did. He just gave a whole bunch away, I think, on the Instagram this year. Actually, he signed a whole bunch and he raised a lot of money for charity, which is really cool. But he was like Doug Sanders. He had hundreds of pairs of shoes.
I did a spotlight thing on that Open during the quarantine and went back and watched it. And I have to say that the fashion across the board, your outfit was the one that might hold up today out of everybody. But, you know, you had the baggy shirts, you had Furyk was in the button down short sleeve.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny when you go back, right? The amount of material in some of those shirts in that period. And it got better by that point. As you said, mine was like, I mean, Puma was pretty cutting edge at that point, and I was actually wearing probably the most conservative thing out of my closet that day, which I was glad. Someone gave me advice when I was really young. I said, wear something that you like. Wear your favorite stuff on Sunday, because if you win, you don't want to wear that ridiculous. You don't have that ridiculous shirt on the wall of the locker room for the next 50 years, right? I can't remember if I made that choice. But yeah, I was happy that I won the US Open, and I'm still happy with what I wore that day. Definitely. I don't regret it. There's some you go back. Some of those ones in the 70s were amazing, what they used to wear. Just amazing. Those big pointy collars and the big white belts.
Yeah, I feel like the 80s was actually the best time for golf. Because the guys, they weren't all wearing hats at that point. You know, I like the no hat look, if people could pull it off.
The no hat thing, or the big fluffy, like almost the perm outside the visor and stuff, like legendary stuff. Yeah, flaps on the shoes. Remember the flaps the shoes over the laces?
Were they called saddles or no?
I don't know, something to just stop water getting in the laces or something. When it was like you had these little tassel-y things.
That's what it was for.
I think so. Yeah,
I didn't even know that. Let's bring those back. I might have to get a pair of shoes for those. So 06 plus 6, obviously extraordinarily hard. There's obviously the massacre. It's never played easy. Can Wingfoot be overpowered?
No, not how they'll set it up. Not how I mean, I read an article this morning in, I think Shackelford posted it. It was in Westchester Journal News. And apparently the rough is nuts, and they've spent all summer like fertilizing the rough and walling the rough and stuff. So I don't believe you can hit enough fairways. You're not going to be able to make birdies just bomb and gouging it, I don't think. Because the greens are such that if you're coming out of the rough, you might be able to hit it on the green with a wedge out of the rough, but you won't be able to get anywhere near the hole. And you'll risk missing in bad spots. So I don't think you can overpower. I think power is a massive advantage in thick rough. Like, it's an enormous advantage in thick rough, just because you can get it out of it and you can get it closer to the green. But the guy who wins will be, everyone will look back and it'll be like, wow, that guy got up and down a lot. That's the guy who'll win. It'll probably be a long hitter, because the best golfers are all long hitters anyway. And everyone will talk about, oh, well, it's different now because he hits it long. But nah, it'll be the guy who gets it up and down the best and manages, who can make pars after missing fairways. That's kind of what I did best that week. When I look back, was inside 100, I was really, really good. So if I missed a fairway, it wasn't the big stress. I'd lay it up just somewhere sort of short of the green, and I just got them up and down all day. And you can play wing foot from short. You can't play wing foot from like past pin high, because you're always coming down the hill.
Yeah. Even pin high in the wrong spot.
Even pin high is too far, yeah.
It's like you have to, but then you have to deal with those false fronts too. You know, so.
Yeah, there's that aspect too. And there's quite a few greens that are kind of a bit up in the air, and you've got to fly it all the way up there too. So it's a good look. There's enough elevation change to make difference. There's 18 crazy greens as you've done that. This beautiful and scary. I mean, it's, you can't overpower it. Power is a massive advantage, but it's not the winning formula there. You're going to have to get it up and down a lot. Like someone like Rahm, I mean, Rahm's 60 play around the greens out of the rough is otherworldly sometimes. If he brings that sort of short game, it's that sort of player, you know?
Yeah, the balance of his game is just, he's great at everything. There's nothing that you look at and say, oh, you know, he really needs to work on that.
No, the only weakness you would say is the one that most of us have, is he gets a little bit spicy from time to time. But we all do that, right? And that's just part of it. And he seems to be way better on that front than he was before. Like, he seems to actually be progressing and learning. And he's still, because he's looked like such a big grown-up man since he was young, he's still only, what, 24, 25?
24, I think, you know? Yeah.
Like, yeah, I mean, yeah, he's got the world at his feet, that kid. And the emotion is good in situations like those. You can, I mean, that being a fiery guy, that's the guy who holds that putt on top of dust and that, you know, in that playoff. The fiery guy, you know, I just, it's good. He wants
it. Be a putt Poulter would make.
Yes, it would be. Wasn't that the most unbelievable finish? That was an unbelievable finish. Yeah, someone like that would be my pick. I mean, Tiger in his prime, you know, what a textbook Tiger player. Great short. Phil too. It's a great Phil place because it helps to be really good with the long game. Like, that's obviously a big advantage, but you've got to do the second two shots on every hole are really important, you know. The third and the fourth shot in every hole.
I just thought back to the beginning of this conversation. How good would Rahm be as a tennis player with how fiery he is?
Yeah, wow. Spanish tennis players, yeah. Be interesting because tennis seems to tilt people with that. I mean, people with that headspace, tennis seems to really drive people over the edge, and it's a little bit more racket smashing. And what a shame about the Joker thing the other day at the US Open. But yeah, it seems, yeah, I couldn't play tennis. I would have broken too many rackets. I wouldn't have been able to handle it. You know?
Yeah.
It would have been crazy.
Golf, you'd see so many more broken clubs if golf was just match play all the time.
Absolutely. And the relationships between the players would be awful, you know, because guys would get guys, you'd have a guy's number and you would beat a guy three times in a row and it would just annoy the guy, you know, and that would be going around everywhere. You know, it would be.
I played a match against this kid once and I had a big lead on the back nine. He starts cutting into it and I didn't give him an 18-inch putt and he missed it. And he went nuts. I mean, he went nuts, went nuclear on me. He was so mad. And I'm like, you missed it. And then the next hole, he did give me like an inch putt. And then at the end of the match, he wouldn't shake my hand.
I love that. That's the best. I love that. That's the best part about match play. That would be the good side. The bad side of the match players with the relationships on tour wouldn't be as good, but the good side would be you'd have fun stuff like that going on. Yeah.
So at Wakefoot, what would you say the 5 to 10 shots? Obviously, it's a US Open. You got to pay attention to every shot. But what are the 5 to 10 or a handful, no number specific, that just really grab your attention that you know you're thinking about maybe ahead in the round?
Well, firstly, whether you tee off on 1 or 10, they are both brutal holes to start on. 10 is a brutal hole to start on. There'll be a 2-tee start, I imagine. 10 is, it's probably only, what, a 7-iron maybe?
They got a new tee
these days. Oh, really?
Yeah, they built it
back towards the
pro shop. Yeah, it's like right next to the pro shop.
Okay. So let's say it's a 6-iron maybe. It's a small green, elevated. If you miss it, you're not getting up and down. It's a stunning hole, but if you miss it, you miss the green, you're probably making bogey your first hole. That's kind of sucks. And the first green is the same. I mean, you could hit it to 20 feet and 4-putt, you know. The story was at 74 that Jack putted off the first green, I think, had a 4-putt. Yeah. So that's the key. I think 1 and 10 to start. If you start on one of those, that's really tough. I think the third, if I go around the court, the third is a brutal hole. Billy Casper famously laid up 4 days in a row, played it as a par four and got up and made played it as a two-shot hole and made four times. That's a key hole. I think 5 and 6 are key holes, although 5's a par four this time. So 5 was a par five for us. So that was 5 and 6 were birdie holes. That was the only little two-hole birdie stretch on the course when we played 5 and 6. Now it's 5 is going to be an interesting nightmare of a par four. I mean, wow, that's going to be really, really hard.
Yeah, because that green is insane.
Insane. Like, completely insane. It was a great par five. It was the only hole that was par five that was reachable because 12 wasn't reachable. It was borderline reachable. And it was the one little respite. If you hit the fairway, okay, at least I'm going to be able to get this next to the green, have an up and down for birdie. And the next one was the same because you had like a little sand iron in 6. And then after that, 7. I mean, it's only like a 9-iron, but 7 is a brutal little par 3. And then 8 and 9 are two of the hardest par 4s in the world back-to-back. And
so you singled out those birdie holes. Is it because hitting a good tee shot there just makes a world of difference and gives you like some sort of life as opposed to like, say, the fourth hole where you got to hit two good shots? You know, most holes you got to hit 2 good shots, but there you have a chance if you hit a really good tee shot at getting one back.
Yeah, and they're so rare. Birdies in US Opens at places like Wingfoot, I mean, they're single digits for the week kind of birdies, you know. So you want to be under before you're over in a round. You don't want to, if you get 3 over after 5, it's like you just can't see 3 birdies to get it back to even par. It's just so hard. So when you have birdie opportunities, are almost more pressure in the US Open because you have to make them, you know. So that was a stretch, and you very rarely get two in a row because the rest of the course around that was really difficult. So
seven, you
you're almost more pressure on the hole. You can make birdie. Seven, you can because it's a short iron. But seven's one of those typical wing foot holes in that, no, a typical US Open style hole that if you hit a good shot, you can make a birdie. If you hit a bad shot, goodness gracious, you know, that green's quite a long way up in the air. And again, short irons, you feel like you're a chance. So you get maybe a little bit more aggressive, but then you miss it just a little bit and you actually make five all of a sudden on an easy hole. Now you've done. Now you've just made double on a hole where everyone else has made par. It's just, it's the relentlessness of a US Open at a place like Wingfoot. It's just 72 holes of really difficult holes and you're going to make more bogeys than birdies. So every bogey is heavier than a normal bogey because it's so much harder to get it back. You know, you're going to have to hit fairways. I mean, the long par fours, you have to hit fairways because you're not going to get it there in two, or you're not going to have any semblance of control coming out of that rough. And the short holes, the shorter holes, like the 6, 11, not many of them really. I mean, 6, 11, I'm struggling for any more short holes that you really love to hit the fairway too, so you can get that wedge. You know, you want that wedge because you just don't have that many chances to have that wedge. So, yeah, what a brilliant place. Yeah, I mean, it's the more you think about the course, I've obviously talked about it a lot recently because of this coming up and people were interested, and it's hard to see anything other than a guy who plays really well all week winning, you know. And I know that sounds dumb. It probably happens everywhere, but you're not going to be able to have a weakness in your game that week. You're not going to be able to work around a dodgy driver or a, like, get around your irons aren't that great. You're going to have to do everything well or you're just going to get completely beaten up, you know.
It's like the reverse of the Masters finish. I remember 2006, the last six holes were six of the eight hardest holes on the golf course. So it's kind of that reverse where, you know, at Augusta, you always have the guy posting early and you're like, oh, he's in the clubhouse at 10, you know? And then it's like, well, in 20 minutes, you realize how just doesn't matter that the guy's at 10. But at Wingfoot, it's like, oh, he's in at 8+8. Maybe he actually has a chance.
And the leaders are at 4 over with 6 to play. He's still got a chance, right? It was like, well, 06... I think out of the last, it was the last 5 or 6 groups, so 10 or 12 guys, I was the only guy to par the last four holes out of the 12 best players of the tournament, which is crazy. And I had to get up and I had to chip in and get up and down twice for that. I got up and down on 16 from 50 yards. I chipped in on 17 for par and I got up and down from the front of 18. So what a finish. And if you go before that, 13 is a strong par three.
Yeah.
Probably 5 iron at the moment, 6 iron maybe, 4 iron could be probably.
Yeah, I mean, it's long.
Over 200. It's over 200. And 14's a strong par 4. 15's a strong par 4. 16's, I think, the longest par 4 on the course. It was in 06. It was 500 in 06. 17's a really awkward little hole with a gnarly little green. And 18 is 18. I mean, missed the fairway and you're not making par. So, yeah, what a finish. 11 and 12, they're a chance. 10's a tricky hole, but if you hit the 10, 11, 12, you hit a good shot on 10, 10, 11, 12, 12's a par 5. It's a long one, but these guys are long, right? But after that, 13 through 18, what'd you say? Was it 6 of the hardest 8 holes in the course?
Last, 13 through 18. The last 6 holes were 6 of the 8 hardest for scoring average.
It's not surprising. Was that just Sunday or was that the whole week? Yeah, wow. Yeah, that's amazing when you think about how hard some of the other holes are. Yeah, it's like that, though. It's that sort of course. So, again, starting on 10 on Thursday morning, that's a tough draw. You know, if you're 1 over after 3 and then you've got those holes coming, it's like, wow.
It's interesting how each 9 gives you almost pockets of scoring where you've got now without 5, it's 6, 7, really, and then 9. But then on the back, it's 11, 12, and that's it.
It's 11, 12, and then you're done. Yeah, that's your scoring done. I mean, massive drives the way Dustin or Brooks or Rory or these guys can hit drivers. they can hit wedges into some of these holes that I can't see wedges into, right? But there's not many, you know, you can't just wail away with driver of the Bryson approach and see if it works out. It's too long a week to have that many shots out of rough. You know, you just can't go all 7, 8, 9 times around being the rough. And I think if you're trying to hit it 330, 340 on every hole, you're going to hit it through some corners and it's going to be firm fairways. It's going to be tough to hit that many fairways. And that US Open rough, I guess from the evidence that I've seen actually this morning on what the rough's going to be like, you're just not going to be able to play around with the rough too much, I don't think. So they'll start backing off the tee a little bit, you know, and then they'll have a bit more long. So it might be interesting that way. We'll see what it'll do to the modern approach. But
I think
you're just not going to be able to take liberties with the rough like you can sometimes.
The other aspect of it is the September date. I think they're going to be able to push the course a little bit more than you would in June. You know, this is the best time agronomically for golf courses in New York.
I would have thought by a long way, and hopefully some trees have started turning maybe a little bit. It's probably not cool enough yet, but the fall is always in the Midwest, New England area. The fall is the best time to play golf, you know, by a long way. Yeah, it's the end of summer, so you've had great growth and you've kind of, it's firm and you haven't had too much rain and it's cool nights and it's not light till 9 o'clock at night. So you can stress the great, they get the cool kind of darkness for longer. Yeah, they could be really fast. It'll be probably in better shape than it was last time just because of that, you know, maybe because of any other factors, but having it at the end of summer rather than the start of summer has got to be an advantage for agronomically, I would think. And they've had less play. They had less play this year, I imagine, right? Just naturally because of COVID probably too.
Maybe more. Everywhere's had record play. I wouldn't imagine that.
Melbourne. Don't come to Melbourne. We're not allowed to play golf in Melbourne.
We at least have golf. We've got a lot more cases though. So, something you said about hitting it in the rough. You can't hit it in the rough all day. Would you say that it's a lot of the U.S. Open is about stress management, almost keeping the stress off you for long periods of time?
Yeah, I think absolutely. I mean, it's a long week even if you're making them. A 6-footer for par, even if it goes in, it's anxiety inducing before you hit it, right? You've got this, I've got to make this putt for par, I've got to make this putt. Whereas a tap in, it's like, oh, you just go tap it in. There's no mental energy drawn from just a tap in. But if you got six, you could shoot even par, but every one of those pars was a 6-foot putt. You're going to be pretty tired at the end of that day. Or you should even par if you've just putted up from 30 feet and tapped it in every hole. You're going to think that was kind of easy. So there's ways and there's ways. And if you're in the rough, you're just going to have long par putts all week and it's just going to wear you out. It's not that you can't do it. It just mentally wears you out. That guy who plays the front nine, he hits 8 greens. The only one he missed was on the front edge. He's tapped it in for par for the front nine. He's cruising around like hasn't used any energy yet. The other guy who shot even par, he's held six 8-footers and 2 5-footers, all left to righters and downhillers. He's on the same score after 9 holes, but he's used all his energy up. So that's like you said, it's the stress avoidance. You know, you just don't want those. You get in situations at a place like Wingfoot where you've missed the green. It's like, right, I know I can't make par. How do I not make double? You know, and those kind of management situations where you've got to hit your bunker shot to 40 feet just because it's going to be somewhere you could 2-putt from, you know, those situations wear you out really quick. They grind you down.
Then you got a 2-putt from 40 feet.
Yeah. And if you're hitting in the rough all the time, you're just going to have situations like that because you just, even if you can move it out of the rough, which it doesn't sound like you're going to be able to move it too far, even if you can, you can't move it with any control. You know, you're kind of trying to get it to an area where maybe you can get it up and down from. You're not like trying to get it close. So it's just, yeah, it's stress management is a good way to, it's energy preservation, you know, and sometimes it's not under your control. I mean, we all aim it in the right spot and it goes there or it doesn't, you know, like, so like we tried it at the rough. I mean, but you could certainly, there'll be an experience. It's a sort of course. It's got some new, quite a lot of depth and nuance to it. Cause it's one of those, it hasn't really been messed with since the old days, right? So it's an old, nuancey kind of course. You would think experience does well, there's certainly an added advantage to experience there than say there would be over, all right, Olympia Fields. I don't know. I don't want to pick on Olympia Fields. Olympia Fields is great, but Wingfoot's just got a little bit extra, you know. And I think as I said, Tiger in his prime would be primo for Wingfoot, you know, because he would just love the challenge of the under the hole thing and the plotting it around and playing it smart and hitting irons off a lot of tees and stuff. I think the guy who embraces that challenge of how do I best manage this, as opposed to just tries to play a good version of normal tour golf, I think the guy who embraces it has a chance to do really well because it's that sort of course.
How would you spend your time leading up to the tournament? Would you just go about your regular practice round, 9-9? It seems like most guys just play 9 nowadays. Or would you spend more time doing different things out there versus a regular tour stop?
Well, look, I love the US Open, clearly. But they ruined Monday to Wednesday in the US Open when they started having tee times in practice rounds. And they don't let us tee off without tee times. And it's a 2-tee tee time. So they have a morning wave and an afternoon wave. Because normally on tour, like pros, 30 times a year, we turn up and we make Tuesdays work. There's no tee sheets. We just get there and it just works. Some guys want to play early. You just kind of find your way to the tee and there's a couple of busy moments, but you pair off with your guys and you play. It actually works really fine. The USGA don't trust us to handle that situation. So we have to put our tee time, and you're booking them like, so they're 4 balls from 7 o'clock in the morning off 1 and 10 from 7 till 9. And then there's 4 balls from like 12 till 2. Well, 4 balls in every group. It's just a 6-hour round. It's a 3-hour 9 holes. There's 50 autographs off the back of every green, which is kind of fun, but everybody's hitting 50 chips on every hole and everyone's taking 25 minutes to play every hole, every group. So after 3 hours of that, no one's going to go, I'll do that again. Can I go to the back 9 like that, please? Like, so that's why that's happened. Everyone would play 18 holes if it was 18 holes. Like it was, everyone plays 18 at the Masters because you play it in 4 hours and it's great fun. You know, practice rounds at the US Open are miserable Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday. And then Thursday, it's great, but that's partly why everyone plays 9 because it takes 6 hours to play 18 holes. I always found the best practice round to play one really early, like 18 holes really early. First group, the 7 o'clock one is not too bad. And then last, I liked Wednesday at 2 o'clock actually because quite often everyone's so pumped and so excited. Monday morning is the busiest time at the US Open because everyone's so jacked to be there, right? By the Wednesday afternoon, everyone's gone. They're all tired. They've all been hitting balls and practicing and hit a million chip shots. Wednesday afternoon's a ghost town. So that was always my go-for thing. But yeah, everyone does just play 9 holes. But what I would focus on in the lead-up, knowing what I know from 2006, I would have spent the last 6 months on the chipping green, you know, working on 60s, working on whenever I could find some heavy rough to chip out of, just get really, really good around the greens because that's what I was doing well at the time. I didn't do that on purpose in 06. It just happened that I was working on my short game a lot and it happened to be the thing that I think was the separator for me at Wingfoot. So I would do that again only because of what happened last time. But in the week leading up, the Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, you couldn't hit enough shots from inside 50, 80 yards, you know, around the greens, out of the rough, and just really get a good feel for getting it up and down somehow and get a feel around the greens. The hitting it, you can work out wherever. You can just look at the book and work out kind of where to hit it sometimes. But the short game stuff, that really is a form thing. You know, it comes and goes. And if you get really sharp and you have that feel, so I'd be doing a lot of that, I think.
Would you say that there's any venue? Do you feel like there's a stylistic, it could look completely different, but from the way the course plays, is there any comp within, whether it's US Open venues or tour stops, anything that is somewhat similar to Wingfoot in the way you have to play?
I think like Wingfoot, Oakmont, Shinnecock, Pinehurst, maybe even Pebble, like prototypical US Open venues, but are all really different, you know. Wingfoot and Oakmont are very similar in that it's all about the greens, you know. Really old school greens, crazy greens that you couldn't build them today. They wouldn't give you another job if you built those greens again today, but yet everybody loves them, you know. Pinehurst the same. You couldn't build Pinehurst number 2 now. There's no way, you know. So I think if they've just got such a great kind of base structure and like the way they were built to begin with to just easily set them up for US Opens. I think Wingfoot is, I mean, I know it's there and it's rose-colored glasses because I won there and all that, but Wingfoot's about as perfect for a US Open tournament, a big tournament, as any venue gets anywhere. Like, they're really, it's a world-class course that's always going to be hard enough. You could set it up easier than they do, you know, but it would still never be very easy because the greens are so challenging. It's 36 holes, so you've got that scale, right? You've got that big clubhouse. You can use the other course for the range. You know, you've just got scale to put all the stuff. And it's just, it's a course that's somewhat intimate, a big course, but it's all kind of close together. So the crowd can kind of see everything really easily. And it's close to the best US Open venue, actually, saying that. I don't want to say that just because they're coming up to it, but can you think of a better one? I mean, Oakmont's a great one, too. Oakmont's a great one, too.
It's easy to get to, too, for a lot of different areas. You know, it's not, if Shinnecock's awesome, but it's a pain in the ass for everybody to get to because unless you're staying on the other side of the island, the traffic's just insane, you know?
Oh, Shinnecock's a nightmare to get to, yeah. It's brutal to get to, yeah, because there's only one way in, yeah.
My next question was going to be, where does it fit in? I think if we went with a tier, you know, it'd be like picking out the best golfer in the world right now. It depends on what week it is or best golf course in the world it is. What's the best golf course in the world? What day of the week is it? You know, what am I in the mood for?
Yeah.
I think with this one, I think it's in that first tier of US Open.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, those courses that I just mentioned, you got Oakmont, Wingfoot, Shinnecock, Pinehurst, probably Pebble. I mean, Pebble, when we play it in the Pro-Am, Pebble's brilliant, but it's not a US Open, but it's a very set-upable course because it's on side slopes and small greens, and as soon as it gets firm, I think Pebble's a great US Open venue. They're tier one. I might have missed a couple. They're certainly, yeah, you can't put anything in front of Wingfoot as a tournament venue, can you? With everything it's got going for it, certainly in the top tier. I mean, Pinehurst is a brilliant week. Oakmont's a brilliant week, but Wingfoot's got 20 million people living within an hour and a half, probably. Yeah. As you say, easy to get to, all the other advantages. Yeah. Top tier. And you shouldn't always go to top tier things because I think some of the other US Opens are really, really interesting. I mean, I thought Chambers was really interesting. Unlucky that the greens today were, but it was a really interesting tournament. I really enjoyed that one.
Did you ever play you never played the Country Club?
I didn't play the Country Club, no.
People have been telling me that that's going to be just a bloodbath in a couple of years.
I don't understand that mentality. It annoyed me a little bit reading the articles at Wingfoot this morning about this is going to be a great Wingfoot Open that we all remember. Hopefully it's 8 over par. It's like, I don't mind if it's 8 over. I mean, I'm glowingly talking about how good Oakmont and Wingfoot are, and we always shoot way over par at those two courses. But if the intent is to get people to shoot 8 over par, I don't like it.
It's kind of like...
if it happens, that's fine.
Like Olympia
but
Field.
If the intent is, I don't understand it.
Like that was... It just naturally, like the weather allowed it to be super firm. And the golf... It's a U.S. Open golf course. They've had U.S. Opens at it. Mm-hmm. And the scores were, you know, what? Two guys ended up under par? Three guys ended up under par? And Wingfoot's obviously much more difficult golf course than Olympia Fields is.
Yeah.
So if it naturally...
I mean, weather dependent, yeah. But you got a bit of wind at Olympia Fields, right?
Yeah. Was there a little bit the first day. But...
Enough, yeah.
It wasn't crazy windy, but it just hadn't rained for 3 weeks, so it was firm.
I just like a setup. And I think Wingfoot... See, what the great, great, great courses do is that even if the setup goes over the top, and they've absolutely gone over the top at setups. I mean, Shinnecock a couple of years ago was over the top. Don't care what anybody says. It was. If the great courses seem to be able to weather that and still have great tournaments and great people win, you know, that's what brings a top-tier course. Like Wingfoot at 5 over or 5 under, great players would win, you know, outside of me.
Oh, come on.
But
you're a top 10 player in the world.
I was being silly, but like, there's other courses that might not do great courses. However you set them up, create great championships. You know, when 06 was a great championship. I mean, with an hour to play, what a last hour of a tournament, right? Shinnecock always provides a great finish. It was a brilliant finish there a couple of years ago. You know, like Pinehurst was dominated. You know, Pebble is usually dominated too. Usually someone separates. It's interesting. But like good players, it doesn't matter how you set up Wingfoot, great players will win and it'll be a great tournament. That's Halo, and the massacre was apparently just absolutely the carnage. But he was one of the best US Open players of all time and he stood up, you know. Zeller and Norman, I mean, they were both at the top of the world at that time. It's like the great courses create great champions.
Yeah.
However you set them up. And there, that's the top tier. The top tier are the ones that do that. Continuously, repeatedly, in different situations, the best players always come out on top. That's, at least from a competitive measuring stick, that's a good measure of a good course, you know.
I mean, yeah, 06, you had Harrington, you had Vijay, you had Phil, Monty. I mean, Furyk. He was the one, I think, that kind of doesn't get enough of, wow. He, you know, everybody obviously always talks about Phil and Monty a little bit, but Furyk, down the stretch, he had probably is kicking himself as much as those other guys are.
Every one of those guys you mentioned had as much chance as me or more with four or five holes to play. Yeah. It's, that was the who's who of the time in 06. It provided the top 10 was like eight guys who were always up there in majors. You know, it was, that's what happened in 06. It was those guys. Tiger was the only exception, but his father, Earl had just died. His father had just died after the Masters and he hadn't really played for 6 weeks and he righted the ship and he won the next two majors after that. So he worked it out, but.
Furyk's US Open.
Yeah, the only exception there was Tiger not being up
there. Furyk's US Open record during that like 5 years is bananas.
Oh, really? So he won Olympia Fields. He was what, top five every year?
Yeah, I think he finished second the year before that. He was in the mix at the Oakmont the next year when Cabrera won. Finished second at Oakmont to Cabrera. He should have won that one.
That's a big one for him because he's a Pittsburgh guy, right? Isn't he a Pittsburgh?
And everybody thought he was going to win, and then I think he made bogey or something on the last hole. I can't remember exactly what happened, but
I just remember Cabrera pumping, hitting that last fairway at Oakmont with driving at like 325. Yeah, Cabrera was just nuts at the time.
Cabrera's one of the great golf stories.
Awesome.
Do you play with him much?
It's funny. So naturally gifted. I play with him a ton. Yeah, we're on some President's Cup teams and stuff. He's a legend. So talented. Almost worked too hard. He was like there's this thing in golf about hard work, right? And like this guilt. And because he came from really poor upbringing in Argentina and he just worked really. He was so naturally gifted. He was probably one of the ones who should have just turned up like Fred Couples to the golf course every day, played golf, had a bit of fun and gone home and had a couple of beers or something. You know what I mean? But he actually went home and hit balls all day, every day. And actually kind of wore himself out by grinding too hard, I think.
Yeah,
that makes sense. No,
totally makes sense.
Supernaturally talented. All those RGs are complete flushes, you know. Legend, bloke. Two majors. I mean, what a career, Cabrera. He was as good as. He nearly won the one that Adam won. He was in the playoff for Scotty at the Masters. I mean, he's the real deal, Cabrera. Flusher.
You mentioned Couples. You channeled a little Freddie Couples before your Wingfoot win with watching sports instead of, you know, getting into your warm-up.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. Like at the time, you just think, why would you be doing something like that? But like when you look back, it's like that's actually the important stuff is to somehow take a little bit of the seriousness out of it. You know, it's not life or death, a golf tournament. You know, 155 guys go away every time not winning. There's only one guy who does, and you lose nearly every tournament you ever play, and you're fine. You're still breathing, and you get to play next week. You know, it's not the end of the world. So I think guys like Freddie and Dustin just have the natural gift at taking a level of seriousness out of it that some of us can't, you know, and it just gives them an advantage in situations like that, I think.
Yeah. Freddie gets bagged on, but that back injury derailed him. I mean, he was getting right to he was winning everything, and then he hurt the back and everything. Hey, so let's wrap it up here, but I need to get your winning predictions, your score and winner.
Well, about a week ago, I predicted to somebody even par and Dustin Johnson that after reading a little bit, I think it'll be over par and I'll go with John Rahm because I think his short game, Dustin will have a little bit of a, it's going to be hard to back up what he's just done.
He's almost too hot.
He's probably had a few beers the last couple of days. I would have thought maybe. Not that he won't be trying his best, but mentally, emotionally, there'll be a period where it'll be hard to keep playing how he's playing. Rahm will be a little bit hungry. You know, he's just won a tournament around a course, the most recent tournament around a course that'll be US Open, like those two are up the top. And he's just got that, he's got the flair around the greens, Rahm, you know. And I'll say he'll win it three over.
It's a strange setup with the major, with it right after the playoffs where all these guys have played 3 weeks in a row.
Mm-hmm.
Where it's, I was talking to a buddy of mine this morning who's on web, and he was talking about how he's played, you know, four straight weeks. And, you know, he was like, oh, I'm going to try and stay away from the golf course a little bit. He's like, because, you know, I need to stay away a little. And I'm like, why? And he's like, well, I played four straight weeks. There's been a lot of golf, but I'm just tired, you know?
Yeah.
And
it just wears you out, leading like those guys do every week. That's just a tiring thing to do.
Yeah, in the mix, yeah. It's different. And he's played well recently. He's like in a lot of great golf, which takes a lot out of me.
Yeah, absolutely. And Rory, you'd think yes, there's a bump when people have babies, but still, wow. I mean, I don't know. It's a hard one.
I kind of wanted to take Rory with everything. Like, I feel like this is kind of, I mean, it's crazy. He hasn't won a major since 2014. It's just nuts.
It's not, I can't understand that. Yeah.
And nuts. I feel like this could be like the shift, like the, just the perception that change that he needs.
Yeah.
Cause something's going on. It's the only explanation I can see is that the majors have gotten in his head a little bit, but Rahm, it's so hard not to pick Rahm.
Well, he ticks every box. And as I said, like, it's a similar game to him and Dustin. They hit it miles, they hit it straight. They're great with everything. Rahm has just that flair around the greens, you know, those guys right at the top. They've all got great short games. But Rahm has that Spanish flair, you know, that extra little bit around the greens that might be a difference maker in that sort of on that sort of course, you know. But look, Webb Simpson could win.
Yeah. It's true.
You know,
Patrick Cantlay could win.
Patrick Cantlay could win. I mean, Morikawa could win without even thinking about it, you know. So
Adam Scott could win.
Scotty could win. He was there in 06. I mean, I wonder if how many of the guys were there in 06. Dustin wouldn't have been there yet.
You know who's a sneaky great pitcher of the golf ball? Who never gets any credit for it? Tony Finau.
Yeah.
Like, great short game.
Absolutely.
But not a great putter.
I don't know. It's going to be that guy who's, I was putting really well at the time, and putting on US Opens, especially late Thursdays and Fridays when the full field's been over the greens, your late tee time is, they're fast and a bit ropey because of the size of the field. Usually it's the great putters who putt well. It's like the guys who putt well at Riviera are the sort of guys who will putt well. Guys who putt well in California will putt well at Wingfoot. You know, just some slopey kind of fast greens. That would be my.
That's a DJ.
I think a DJ. Yeah, it is. It's because that new, all of a sudden, I mean, the West Coast is a unique putting experience, but Westchester County up there is a similar green. There's a bit of a power issue, similar grassing as the California greens, and they can get fast and slopey and smooth in the morning and bumpy in the afternoon. That is usually only the elite putters, you know, on stuff like that, or that free putter. The guy doesn't stress about putting, you know, which would be a Dustin. He's not an elite putter, but he's certainly a non-stress putter, you know. Snedeker, he used to make everything in California. Morikawa, he's just won there. They're not the same, but there's a similarity to putting, I would have said, at Riviera and Wingfoot, a surface of the green-wise and speed-wise.
Man, this would be so good for Brooks if he was...
Yeah, it's Brooks, absolutely. I mean, it's Brooks, of course, as I've ever seen 2 years ago, you know, if he was healthy and, yeah, absolutely.
All right. Excited for this week. Anything you're particularly excited to watch?
I'm just excited to watch the whole thing. I'm really, the whole thing, really. I'm going to soak it up. It'll be nostalgic a little bit to watch it. You know what I mean? Just interested to see it unfold.
It's a bummer. Bummer you're not playing.
Yeah, it's a shame. You know? When we were going back up until March and the COVID thing, I was certainly going to be there playing if I could, but be there either way, and I can't. So that's a shame, but no, it'll be fun to watch. Since it's been such a crazy year that golf is, as I said at the start, all of us, they started canceling the Masters, canceling all those tournaments, like, oh my God, it's like Armageddon for like tour golf. But 6 months later, it's like tour golf is actually doing it better than every other sport. And it's powering, and we've got tournaments and FedEx Cups, and we're having all these majors, and it's like, wow, like, just excited that it's happening. You know, so I just want to watch, because my the big memories of Wingfoot for me in that tournament was the last hour. And because of how the last hour was, I'm looking forward to seeing the last hour again. You know, like,
have you ever rewatched?
If we can actually get five or six guys with a chance with an hour to play, oh, it's going to be fun to watch, you know?
Have you ever rewatched that? Is that something you've done?
Not in its entirety. I haven't watched it in its entirety, like the 5-hour coverage or whatever, but I've watched the last few holes a couple of times, and I've been to a bunch of dinners and things where they'll show footage from the thing, like as part of the talk or something. But I've never sat down and watched the whole thing start to finish. I should, but see, I'm on the coverage early, up to about the first 5 or 6, and then Phil kind of takes over the coverage for most of it, you know, and I kind of pop up there towards the end because there's so many guys in contention, and it was Phil's kind of coronation week, Tommy Roy, you know, I mean, they pick the guy who's going to get the most ratings. It's perfect, right? So it's not like watching me play 18 holes. You probably saw me play, you missed a punch of me in the middle, you know what I mean, an odd putt here or the odd shot here, so...
They put the final 2 hours up on YouTube, and that's what we watched when we did this spotlight thing. And it was the coverage opens with Kenny Farron,
yeah,
and he's just really mad.
That's the
it's just
the trivia question at the trivia night: who played with Phil in the last round of the 06? Kenny Farron was playing really well. He had a little sweet spot. He played well for a couple of years in there, and he was playing the last group of the US Open, but. Yeah, he didn't have a good day that day, I don't think, did he?
No, the crazy thing was he hit a wedge shot on 11 or something, and he was, like, slamming his club, and he was +7 at the time.
Really?
It's like, dude, you're in it.
You're in it. You're in
you
it.
Know? And he's, like, melting down, you know? And you're just like, but yeah, you know, it's just like one of those things where he probably felt like he was shooting a million, you know?
Well, it's funny.
So out of it, because...
Yeah, that's the best advice I got. I got... Judy Rankin is, while my wife's sister married Judy Rankin's son. So okay. Judy Rankin is my sister-in-law's mother-in-law. There you go. So anyway, so Judy is close. I've been close with Judy for a long time, and Thanksgiving dinners and stuff, Judy's there. But anyway, I get a note on Sunday morning or a text from Judy on Sunday morning saying, and I'm 2 behind playing in the second last group. She goes, never be... Everyone always opens a newspaper on Monday morning and they're surprised about how high the score was that won the US Open. Never think you're out of it today. You never know what's going to win. And that was exactly to your point with Kenneth Ferry. It's say that's the thing. However bad it's going in the US Open, it's always higher, the score that wins, than you think. So you view it like that. You know, it was really good advice. You know, just wait for everyone to go away as opposed to kind of panic and force it.
This is good advice. Yeah. It's good advice for almost everything.
Yeah. Yeah.
In life.
US Opens especially though, yeah, because you're 2 over after 2 on Thursday and you're like calling your travel agent, right? But everybody's 2 over after, you know, it's like, it's just part of it. You just 10 over could win the tournament. So just hang in there, you know?
All right. Well, hey, thank you for coming on. Excited to hear your thoughts after, and look forward to another, hopefully as dramatic of one as 06.
Yeah, I mean, that's what I was saying. I mean, it'd be brilliant if we could get like 5 or 6 guys with a chance with an hour to play. It'd be great. I mean, if it's a procession, that's fun to watch too, right? If a guy wins by 5. But any lead, it's not going to be safe. You know, like you said, if a guy posts 6 over and you're 3 over on the 15th tee, they're not giving you the tournament yet, you know? So yeah. It's going to be fun to watch.